Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the sanctioned by popular opinion two guests today. The political scientist Larry Bartels will talk about the sources of the right populist upsurge around the world, and the journalist and organizer Sopo Chaparidze will explain the recent turmoil in Georgia, the country, not the state. Larry Bartels has been on this show several times before, but it's been 7 years since his last appearance, which is too long. I find reading and listening to him really bracing. His work really challenges some core beliefs about democracy. When I told him that he made me doubt popular capacities for self-rule, he responded by calling it charming. His analyses of why people vote the way they do contradict a lot of academic and non-specialist explanations. Voters' decisions are often very ill-informed and their opinions often deeply contradictory. His most famous finding, though it's a controversial one, is that random events like shark attacks, drought, and floods can affect elections. Incumbents are often punished for things that are way beyond their influence, much less control. Bartels has an article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, The Populist Phantom, which argues that the rise of right-wing populism, Trump, Orban, Le Pen, is not driven by major changes in public opinion. For Bartels, it's politicians that are leading the way. Or, as the subtitle of the Foreign Affairs article puts it, threats to democracy start at the top. It's hard to say whether that's comforting. It's good to hear that the backlash isn't driven by growing mass rage. But on the other hand, the capacity of politicians to whip up fear and hatred to serve their own ends is chastening. Larry Bartels is a professor of political science at Vanderbilt. His books include Democracy Erodes from the Top, published last year, Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government, from 2016, co-written with Christopher Aachen, and Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age, from 2008. Larry Bartels. Anything about recent election that makes you want to rip up your Foreign Affairs article and start all over again, or you still pretty much stand by it?
The general discussion of right-wing populism in contemporary politics has focused mostly on the rhetorical style of political leaders who are attempting to appeal to people basically by arguing against the legitimacy of the existing political system or the existing political leaders. So it's really a kind of political approach that could be applied to lots of different specific contexts and issues. In my work on Europe, what I've mostly focused on is the kinds of political attitudes that have been measured consistently in surveys over the last couple of decades that turn out to be predictive of support for right-wing populist parties. So things like anti-immigration sentiment and opposition to European integration and political distrust. Those are the particular kinds of arguments that right-wing populists have been appealing to recently. But as you say, you can imagine from historical examples and even other contemporary examples, a lot of ways in which political leaders could use populist arguments to try to appeal to people.
The media really loves to heat this up, but by your reading, there's not been a massive transformation in public opinion that's driven this populist upsurge. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, I think it's important to distinguish between two levels of manifestations of changes at the level of the mass public. One, which is what most pundits focus on because it's most visible, is how many votes these parties get in elections. And there has been some increase in electoral support for right-wing populists in a variety of places over the last couple of decades, but it's pretty modest and I think exaggerated in the public understanding because, as you say, the media loves these stories. And so every time one of these parties rises, it gets a huge amount of attention. And then when they fall or plateau, there's much less attention paid to that. But maybe more importantly, part of the error that pundits often make is to interpret these shifts in voting behavior as shifts in the underlying public sentiment. And that's seldom the case. It turns out that variation in the support for these parties is almost always mostly a function of what I'll call the supply side rather than the demand side. There are lots of places where these parties didn't exist and now offer alternatives to voters that they might well have taken 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but just didn't have as an alternative, and now they do. And so you see shifts to these parties that don't really reflect any underlying shift in public opinion. And in fact, if you measure things like anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, it turns out that there really isn't much change over the course of the 21st century. If anything, people on the whole have become more favorable toward immigrants than less, but you certainly wouldn't guess that from the media coverage, which focuses largely on instances of friction and the most extreme anti-immigrant sentiment.
Is there any relation between anti-immigrant sentiments across Europe and the presence of immigrants in the population?
No, very little, actually. It turns out that symbolically having an influx of immigrants makes a big difference, but in terms of overall patterns of opinion, you see very little change. For example, in response to the refugee crisis that many European countries faced in 2015 and 2016, and in general, the places where the level of immigration has increased most over the 21st century are mostly not the places where there's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. In Sweden, for example, they've had a pretty substantial influx of immigrants, but they remain one of the most welcoming countries in terms of overall public opinion toward immigrants, in spite of the frictions that they faced from the increases in immigration.
It seems that the media attention to this is like an example of the old aphorism, if it bleeds, it leads. They just love this sort of thing that heats things up, but not much truth value there necessarily.
Right. But it has inspired political leaders to appeal to that segment of public opinion that existed all along. There's always talk when people write about populism of this global wave of populism, but my metaphor is that it's not a wave, it's a reservoir that's been there all along. And in recent years, at least in a lot of places, politicians have been more successful in tapping into it, but the reservoir has been there for a long time. And if it wasn't immigration, political leaders might well find other kinds of unhappiness in the public to appeal to in order to try and build support.
And then politicians in places like Hungary and Poland have really been scapegoating immigrants, even though they don't necessarily have many of them. But that's really been driving a lot of what is perceived as anti-immigrant sentiments in the population.
Yeah, and in fact, even classifying those places as takeovers by right-wing populists is a little bit misleading. It turns out, if you look at the survey data before Orban came to power in Hungary or before the Law and Justice Party won in Poland, support for those parties was really pretty much uncorrelated with the kinds of factors that were important in predicting support for right-wing populist parties in Western Europe. In both cases, they ran as pretty conventional alternatives to failed incumbent parties and were elected without overwhelming popular support, but in particular, without support that seems to have been driven by the kinds of things that have driven support for right-wing populist parties in Western Europe. But then when they got into power, they took advantage of the opportunity to exploit the system to try and entrench themselves in power. And one of the things they did, as you say, was to scapegoat immigrants and to try and build up anti-immigrant sentiment and anti-EU sentiment as ways to convince people that they were the true protectors of national identity.
The standard explanation for a lot of this is that globalization has left a lot of people behind, people particularly in previously industrial regions ravaged by deindustrializations. And this brand of populism is a response, or relatedly, a reaction to globalization, or in Europe, the growth of the EU. Another angle, the 2008 financial crisis left everyone in a state of shock, and populism is a response. You don't agree with these analyses, right?
Well, I think there are certainly places where the economic circumstances have contributed to people's frustration. But on the whole, I think that explanation doesn't work very well. If you look at the wake of the Euro crisis, there wasn't a big upsurge in support for right-wing populist parties, at least in terms of public sentiment in the places that fared worst in the Euro crisis, often were not places where right-wing populist parties gained traction. If you look at Spain, for example, which was pretty hard hit, throughout the Euro crisis, they were kind of a glaring exception to the overall rise of right-wing populism in Western Europe. And then Vox came along well after the worst of the Euro crisis was over and appealed to Spaniards for reasons that didn't really have much to do with economic disaffection. And if you look at the patterns of support for right-wing populist parties, there are very few places where economic disaffection registers at all, really, as an important factor in explaining their support. But there is a correlation between the kinds of places that are deindustrializing and where people have been hurt economically and the older, lower educated segments of the population that tend to be most unwelcoming of the cultural changes, which I think are really at the heart of whatever shifts there have been in populism as a kind of general political sentiment. I would say the same thing about the US, although people like to point to closed factories as being the real motivating force here. I think the more important factor is that those kinds of places tend to be populated by people who are generally unwelcoming of this huge burst of social change that we've had over the last half century, and that's really the most important driving issue behind the rise of populism.
You cite the work of John Sides, Michael Tesler, and Lynn Varick, and their book in the 2016 election. They found the biggest shifts in voting patterns were related to education, not income, and those shifts primarily reflected attitudes about race and ethnicity, not the classic economic anxiety. Could you expand on that?
That's another instance of this general pattern and fits well with what I've seen in the European data as well, that if you look for people who express in surveys economic distress or disaffection of some sort, they just aren't mostly the people who are moving in the direction of right-wing populist parties in Europe or of Trump and the Republicans in the US.
Inflation did play a significant role in this election. Is that a different story, though?
Well, I think we don't know yet the extent to which inflation was an important factor. It's always, I think, a mistake to rely too heavily on what people say about the motives for their own vote choices, because they're largely influenced by the rhetoric of the campaign. And so if the people that they end up voting for are talking about inflation, they're going to end up talking about inflation. But I haven't seen a lot of evidence, and I think it's hard to generate evidence just given the nature of inflation, which is a uniform factor working across, you know, all kinds of geographical places and demographic groups to sort out the impact of inflation from other kinds of factors. I'm waiting to see more evidence that it really was an important driving force behind people's votes.
Stepping back to some of the public opinion questions, there are contradictions on a lot of the survey work. For example, in the U.S., we have people saying throw them all out, and at the same time, give them pathway to citizenship. How do you reconcile these contradictions?
I don't. I mean, I just take it as a feature of public opinion that it's often contradictory and shallow and can be shifted pretty significantly by elite rhetoric that encourages people to focus on one issue rather than another, or one aspect of an issue rather than another. We have this idea that people ought to have well-formed general ideologies that lead them what to think about everything, but ordinary people have their lives to live and they don't spend all of their time thinking and talking about politics. And so maybe it shouldn't be surprising that there are these contradictions in the way they think about things.
You say that their attitudes around immigration reflect an increasing intensity of a feeling among a minority, not the massive, irresistible tide of popular conviction. So is that a way to read these opinion polls?
Yeah, I think if you look across Europe, and this is true in the U.S. as well, as I said, if anything, there's been a kind of gradual increase in welcoming attitudes toward immigration over the course of the 21st century. There are people who are strongly opposed to that, but even the proportion of people who, you know, are in that tail of the distribution of opinion hasn't increased rapidly, or at least until the last few years. Most of the impression that there's a wave of anti-immigrant opinion has mostly to do with the media's eagerness to focus on people who aren't representative of the public as a whole.
In a lot of cases, these populist politicians have remade the parties that they rode to power, or really remade the landscape, the political landscape. Trump remaking the Republican Party and shaking up the entire political spectrum in the U.S. Orban remade his own party. Is it these leaders with access to party and state power more than the upsurge of popular opinion? Is that where we should look for a lot of the action?
I think so. The story is different in different places. Orban had been the leading figure in the Fidesz party for many years before they came to power in 2010. He had actually been the prime minister previously, and during the time that he was out of power, had pretty complete control over the apparatus of the party. So when they were elected in 2010 with a pretty slim popular majority, but the way the electoral system worked there, that translated into exactly two-thirds of the seats in the National Assembly, which was exactly what they needed to be able to amend the Constitution and engage in significant institutional backsliding. They were able to do that because he had such lockstep control over the party. U.S. parties are much more disorganized, and Trump certainly didn't have lockstep control over the Republican Party when he was elected in 2016. And indeed, much of what was accomplished in the way of policy in his first term was really the agenda of the mainstream Republican establishment more than it was the agenda of Trump specifically. But he's been very successful, I would say, in winning over the Republican establishment and the Republican organization. And I think part of the reason for that, a kind of little notice factor in his success, is that the Republican establishment was really unpopular with the Republican rank and file at the time that Trump came along. I was struck by the results of a survey that I did partway through Trump's first term that just asked people how favorable or unfavorable they felt toward a lot of different political figures. And Republicans' views of Trump himself, even after he'd been in the White House for a while, weren't really all that favorable. They were much less favorable, for example, than Democrats' views of Barack Obama, who'd been retired for a while at that point. But even so, Republicans' views of Trump were much more favorable than their views of the Republican Party in general or of George W. Bush, which were more favorable than their views of Paul Ryan, which were more favorable than their views of Mitt Romney, which were more favorable than their views of Mitch McConnell. So if the mainstream Republican leadership was trying to tell them during the 2016 nominating period that Trump was not the guy they should support, it maybe shouldn't have been so surprising that that didn't have much impact on the rank and file. And then when Trump became the leading figure in the party and got so much attention, you know, during his campaign and then after he was elected, he was pretty successful in recasting ordinary Republicans' views about what the Republican Party was. If you look, for example, at Republicans' views about Putin and Russia, they shifted radically over a very short period of time in response to Trump's rhetoric, which is another indication, I think, of how flexible ordinary people's political views often are.
Well, you can say the same about Trump. It's not like he has a very rigorous ideology.
No, that's right. I mean, there are some things that he feels strongly about and some things where his views seem to be kind of invented at the spur of the moment.
Now, the Dems campaigned on Trump as a threat to democracy. They were all about preserving democracy, or what we have of one. I'm not sure how much of an impression that line made. Do the masses really care that much about democracy?
My impression is that that wasn't a very successful line of argument. We'll need more detailed survey evidence, I think, to be sure. But my general impression from the literature on this subject, which goes back more than half a century, is that people will express in general a lot of support for democracy and for democratic norms and procedures. But if you get even a little bit below the surface, that support turns out to be pretty shallow once it comes to trading off their support for democracy in the abstract against their support for their own substantive political values or preferences. Most people are likely to be willing to sacrifice democracy or to convince themselves that what they want to do is not really a threat to democracy because they are more concerned about supporting a particular political figure. There have been recent survey experiments done by political scientists that provide people with, you know, hypothetical choices between a candidate who supports your views but has taken or supported some kind of undemocratic action and a candidate who you are less amenable to in terms of his substantive political platform. And it turns out in those studies that the apparent cost of violating democratic norms is really quite minor. I did a more concrete test of this along with Nick Carnes in a study we did looking at the support in 2022 for Republican members of Congress who had supported Trump's effort to decertify electoral votes after the riot on January 6th. There was a wave of punditry right after the 2022 election about how some prominent election deniers had lost their bids for office and that this was a triumph of democracy. Mostly those were kind of nutty candidates who would not have been successful under any political circumstances. But if you look at the incumbent members of Congress and differentiated between those who went along with Trump's Stop the Steal efforts and those who didn't, there's really no evidence that there was either a penalty or a reward in the general electorate for that kind of behavior. And in fact, the people who were most supportive of Trump were actually rewarded in some ways in terms of the likelihood of primary competition, likelihood of getting booted in the primaries by comparison with the minority of Republicans in Congress who did not cooperate with Trump's efforts.
You say towards the end of your piece that the fate of democracy lies in the hands of politicians. It is they who choose to manage, mollify, ignore, or inflame populist sentiment. It's a dangerous blunder to gullibly accept their show of bowing to the ostensible will of the people. Could you expand on that?
My general view is that most of what happens in democratic politics is based on the decisions of political leaders. We have this, what Chris Aiken and I have called a folk theory of democracy that tries to interpret everything one way or another in terms of the impetus of public opinion filtering up through the system. But in fact, elections are not a sufficiently tight means of accountability to make voters responsible for most of what their elected officials actually do. If you look at the literature in comparative politics on full-blown breakdowns of democracy, it comes to similar kinds of conclusions. There are many places in which voters went out of their way to vote for dictatorship, but when political elites foisted dictatorship on them, they were often passive in their response and were willing to go along with it rather than attempting to resist to the full extent of their potential power. And I think the same story holds with a lot of instances of democratic backsliding that we've seen recently. I told the story of Hungary, where there really wasn't a popular impetus for democratic backsliding. It was something that Orban decided to do because he had the opportunity after he had been elected for other reasons. And similarly, I think the people who've voted for Trump and for the Republican Party are really doing it not because they want an authoritarian shift in American politics, but because they see Trump and the Republicans as the heroes and the protectors of their deeply held values and the people who are, if not doing anything about, at least paying lip service to their really intense cultural concerns and anxieties.
And finally, I'm curious about why the politicians will do this populist inflaming thing. Is it their own will to power, or are there changes in elites that prompt them to do it? I'm thinking, for example, of the growing importance of a wing of the business class that is very much in Trump's corner. Frackers and Silicon Valley guys and hedge funders who want tax cuts and deregulation don't care about much of anything else. But in the case of Thiel and people like him around Silicon Valley, they explicitly don't like democracy. Is that a factor at all?
I'm not sure how important that is. I think if anything, actually, the Republicans are going to have some difficulties facing possible contradictions between the concrete policy agenda that the business wing of the Republican Party still wants to pursue and the more populist rhetoric and in some cases genuine populist impulses of other parts of the current Republican coalition. But I guess I would say generally my sense is that politicians are often willing, when they're able, to attempt in one way or another to entrench themselves in power. One of the books I always like to cite in this respect is by my Vanderbilt colleague, Jessica Traunstein. It's called Political Monopolies in American Cities. And she looks at lots of these urban political machines in the 19th century and early 20th century in the US, which often managed to entrench themselves for decades at a time in political control through all kinds of manipulation of the rules of the game. And then eventually they would slip and get voted out of office, as the right-wing populists in Poland did last year. And then some reformist coalition would come in and they would attempt to entrench themselves in power, often using some different set of mechanisms that appealed more to their ideology and their coalition of supporters. But maybe what requires explanation in some ways is not why politicians sometimes engage in this kind of behavior, but why so often their self-restraint prevents them from exercising the opportunities that they might have to gain that sort of political power.
That was Larry Bartels, professor of political science at Vanderbilt and author of The Populist Phantom in the November-December issue of Foreign Affairs. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the intoxicatingly gorgeous first movement of Franz Schubert's Piano Sonata No. 21, D950, performed by Alfred Brendel. Next, Georgia, the transcontinental country in Eastern Europe and West Asia, not the state where General Sherman executed his most famous work. In October, the country held parliamentary elections, and the ruling Georgian Dream Party won 53% of the popular vote and a comfortable, if not commanding, majority of seats. The election was immediately denounced as fraudulent by the usual Western judges, the U.S. and the EU. The president, whose name I don't dare pronounce, here's my guess, Sopo Jabaridze's pronunciation,
Zurabishvili,
who was once an ally of Georgian Dream, but then turned on it, joined in the denunciations. Last year, the government instituted a requirement that the horde of NGOs in the country disclose their foreign financing, of which there is plenty. This was also seen by the U.S. and EU as anti-democratic, as if the U.S. would ever tolerate such activity here. Georgians have been in the streets protesting over the past week, demonstrations that are inevitably presented in our media as pro-democracy. What's going on? Here to address that is Sopo Jabaridze, a Georgian-American organizer and journalist. Georgia held parliamentary elections on October 26th, and some people don't like the results, notably the president, who is inevitably described as pro-Western in the news stories here. She says there was rampant fraud, and she wouldn't observe the new parliament selection of a president in a few weeks. What are these claims of fraud based on, and what do you make of them?
I've been following this very closely, and I don't think it was a fraudulent election. I think there's like the sort of a garden variety of rigging that always happens in every election. But as far as like somehow the way that has been portrayed is totally rigged, I do not adhere to that. And especially because it took them a while. Like they first announced that it was fully rigged and it was a Russian takeover, a Russian special operation. And then we will now find how they rigged it. So it was already like from the beginning assumed rigged, and then looking at various theories of rigging. So after going through a process of first trying to find out how it was rigged, multiple competing theories, and then over time, the thing that they thought would get them a new election was saying that the ballots were seen through, like it bled on the other side, but it had a cover, and it was like 6% that was actually identified by the international mission that had over 500 observers. But they're saying that the privacy of voting was violated, and so there should be new elections.
Before we go on, I just want to make it clear, you're not a big fan of this government, right?
No, I think there's lots of things that they have done. They're like a typical neoliberal government that's sold everything, privatized everything, and so on. However, I do think the last 2 years, things have kind of changed because of the war in Ukraine. So since Russia's invasion, EU has become incredibly hostile and warmongering. And I believe the crisis currently stems from that more than it does from the government.
Yeah, the EU is a big issue here. How does that figure in Georgian politics?
It's huge. EU integration has been on the political agenda since the association agreement, and it became fast-paced or sort of sped up when in 2022, with Moldova and Ukraine, Georgia submitted an application for a candidate status in the EU. Everybody was sort of applying to NATO and applying to EU moment. Georgia submitted alongside Ukraine and Moldova. All three were granted EU candidacy status. And then things started falling apart. There's already been, the last few years, this attempt to paint Georgian Dream as pro-Russian. And there have been multiple protests and so on with various reasons to protest. The main opposition party, which is a former ruling party, has been pushing this line that they're pro-Russian or Russian for a while. It started really gaining traction when Georgia did not go along with the sanctions against Russia, because there's a very tense situation with Russia, with occupied territories, and there's been two wars with Russia already. And so it's something that the government refused to do. And also because through this sanctioning, Georgia, like other countries, became like hubs where all the Western countries are using to get their materials into Russia. So this way to evade sanctions has also been a huge boost to the Georgian economy, not only to Georgia, but other countries as well. And of course, most of them are coming from the Western countries. With this sort of boost in the economy, and also this fear that taking a more and more warmongering stance against Russia, like the Baltic countries have done, is not wise. And so Georgian Dream ran on a platform that they are a pro-peace party. We are in an explosive area. We need to have a much more careful politics, foreign politics. This just read to the opposition and also the EU as somehow pro-Russian. Having any kind of neutrality or careful circumspection and so on is looked upon as a pro-Russian policy.
Given the realities of geography and politics, it's not like Georgia can ignore Russia or even promote hostilities with the country. I mean, it does have to get along with this giant neighbor.
The opposition does not think that. They believe that Georgia needs to remain as hostile as possible. This sort of is more complicated because Ukraine's government has a lot of former ruling party members in it. Some of the leadership called on Georgia to open up a second front against Russia. The Georgian Dream founder, the billionaire Bidzina Ivanishvili, said something like this, that the prime minister of Georgia at the time was approached by some Western government and was told to open up a second front. And the prime minister had asked them, had told them, how long do you think we can last if we open up a second front? And they said 3-4 days. And he said, why are you risking our entire country for 3-4 days? And they said, well, then you can go and do like guerrilla fighting in the mountains and so on. And we can defend you and send you money. Georgian Dream's relationship with Western leaders started really deteriorating. And what also happened is during the sanctioning of Russian assets and so on, Credit Suisse froze the billionaires' money without any reason. And so for a year and a half, they just recently was unfrozen after winning some of these lawsuits against them. So for a year and a half, his money was frozen. And in the same interview, he says that he was called to meet with U.S. politicians while his money was frozen. And he saw this as a way to influence Georgian politics using his personal funds.
This is the founder of Georgia Dream?
Yes, yes. He said that's why he had stopped communicating, because he felt like they were using his money as like ransom. Through all this, the EU parliament also, there's like tons of lobbyists and also just a lot of supporters of the former government in EU parliament, who are mostly coming from the very conservative group, EPP, which have made multiple resolutions now condemning Georgian Dream, saying democratic backsliding. The EU parliament has become an instrument to pass resolutions against the government. And so it's like the opposition parties and NGOs have access to EU parliament more than the government does. And the government is looked upon as totally unreliable. So they completely defer to whatever so-called civil society or opposition parties tell them. And some of these resolutions look like it was written by the opposition. Resolutions that have gotten increasingly more drastic against the government, like the last one a few days ago, which was to call for non-recognition of the government internationally, to sanction multiple people, including the billionaire, and to call for new elections and so on. So it's like a very hostile environment that the EU has become an arena of where opposition can reign. And then you have flurry of EU politicians and US politicians like Blinken make tons of comments, interventions, you know, condemnations. The US has sanctioned a few people in the government, taken away visas, took away some money. EU has also frozen some money. So it's been like nonstop pressure. And so right before the elections, there was a lot of pressure for the Georgian people to choose sort of wisely who they were going to elect. At the same time, like while millions of euros were being frozen for Georgia, they were giving more money to Moldova, who they have Maia Sandu, which is a pro-EU, everything the West tells me is good, president. So they were sort of punishing one and trying to give carrots to the other, you know?
You mentioned NGOs. These are a very prominent feature in Georgian society. One of the things that sets off the Westerners is a law that restricted the operations of some of these foreign-funded organizations and was caricatured as being modeled on Russian law. So what about these NGOs? What is their role? What is this government regulation designed to do? And how do they figure in Georgian society?
NGOs are very prominent. They range from big think centers that have huge sway and power to basic health service or, you know, mammogram. I find it almost like not a good term to describe what we mean by NGOs because it is such a huge spectrum. The NGOs that the government was more targeting, let's say, with the law, foreign transparency law, was about these huge NGOs that have a lot of sway with Western institutions. There was complete disapproval of any transparency. I could not expect the level of outrage, but the EU seemed, not only the NGO Georgian types, but the EU really had a terrible, very angry reaction to it. And they have used this law in almost every single statement they've made, and even signs when the election took place. Whoever the government is needs to repeal this law. So I was like, this law became a huge part of the struggle between EU, the NGOs, and Georgian government. They took it as an attack on the West because most of this money, of course, is coming from the West. Like, how dare you sort of say that we are foreign influence in Georgia?
I'm speaking with Sopa Japaridze, a Georgian journalist and union organizer. I was just looking at the NED's webpage for Georgia, and by their own disclosure, they're funding journalistic organizations, youth organizations involved in the electoral realm. They're deeply involved in Georgian politics. Now, the United States wouldn't tolerate that for a second if a foreign agent was meddling in journalism and politics. The extent of the involvement is really quite impressive.
It is. And I think that's what makes it alarming for any government to have this much power and this much resources in very uncontrolled sector, right? Like, it's not regulated at all. And then they have a direct line to politicians who, anything happens, politicians immediately start making statements against the government, passing EU resolutions. It's a huge power to have. It's also influencing EU accession. EU accession has now been halted. I can understand how a country that's completely funded by the West and everyone's sort of interest is the middle class, the most sort of vocal and organized part of Georgia, is very much vocal and can always count on Western leaders to come to its rescue whenever they don't like anything the Georgian dream does.
The U.S. State Department said a couple of days ago that Georgian people overwhelmingly support integration with Europe. What's the truth of that?
Polling, right? I think it's interesting how they use that often because it's polling. Polling says that, yes, they do support integration in probably the highest numbers of anyone ever asked in any country. But I think that if you asked a lot of other polls, which they used to do more, they would also want normalization with Russia. And by normalization, I mean being able to trade and so on without having any problems. The way that poll has been used often is this very nefarious way. I don't think that is a good indicator of what they mean by this. If EU integration means constant tension with the rest of the world, I don't think that you would have the same responses. I think for most Georgians, it's very, they're pragmatic. I mean, I think the middle class, the elite urban middle class, I think they're not pragmatic only. They're also ideologically committed because they believe they're Europeans and they have been denied their right to be Europeans. But I think other people are very pragmatic. Like, they're like, oh, okay, if you're going to offer me something good, I'm going to be there. You know, if you're going to offer me this, it's good too. Like, but the fact that one may be mutually exclusive from the other is something that they don't really think about. So I think all those things should be sort of taken with a grain of salt, because the president of Georgia kept saying, how did Georgian Dream win the elections when most people support the EU? Polling that shows EU support and Georgian Dream winning elections are not the same thing. Like, one, polling is a very different phenomenon than voting. And it also does not take into account every other factor. And two, Georgian Dream is also saying, oh, we want the EU. They're saying we want a different path. They keep saying with dignity to EU. That's their statement. While the opposition is like, we'll do whatever you want to the EU. We will be the best you've ever seen. You will see, we love Europe more than ever. If you just let us in, we'll be the cheerleaders of Europe, you know? Let's say a very undignified way to Europe.
There are a lot of people in the streets demonstrating. The government is responding with water cannons and repressive measures. Who are these people in the streets? What's the constitution of the protest?
So the elections took place. Georgian Dream won. The opposition tried to do these protests that the election was rigged, but the numbers just kept dwindling. They didn't have a plan. The only plan they've been able to succeed is getting the Western governments from recognizing the elections, which they have done. While they keep the Western governments recognizing, they tried to also sue in court. They lost, and they then sue and tried to take the case to the election commission. They also lost. They've done sort of street protests, some kind of performance stuff where they sprayed paint all over the head of the election commission. So they have been doing lots of things, but it hasn't really been tracking. They've really just pretty much dwindling down. And then EU Parliament passed a resolution like about 3 or 4 days ago now, non-recognition of the government and so on. Sanctions, you know, very interventionist, completely outside of any normal relations And then right afterwards, Georgian Dream Prime Minister said that we will be suspending EU accession talks until 2028. Backstory is the EU accession was already suspended by the EU. Georgian Dream just responded with, okay, then we also say no. Okay, you can go f*** yourself if you like, because you're not constructive. Their whole thing is EU is not constructive. You know, at this point, it's being taken hostage by these sort of warmongering, these kind of radicals that continually use their place to blackmail the government. So that's how they see it. The opposition took this as they're saying no to the EU. Prime Minister and other GD representatives were like, no, we will be continuing the association agreement, doing everything that we are supposed to do to be able to integrate with Europe. And they keep saying, like, we actually are better on all measures than Moldova or Ukraine. You know, like, we've actually done more to integrate into the EU than they have. So we will continue. It's just that we will now stop this accession back and forth that we've had, because every 6 months, they have to vote on if the candidate status stands and if the accession will take place. To avoid that, this constant EU telling them they have not fulfilled all of their requirements and so on, and becomes like a political tool internally, they said, we're going to take a break and then come back. This was looked upon as them showing their true face of being pro-Russian. So the president made a statement pretty much saying, this is like a police and army. Don't go along with traitorous government. Stand by the people. Then the protests erupted, and she went up to the police and said, how much money are you getting to serve Russian government? Which is a strange thing to say to someone you clearly want on your side. Then the protesters were saying, Russian slaves, like to the cops and to the government. That first night, there was not that many young people. And so there was some violence by protesters, though compared to now, it was very light. The police responded back with a lot of force. They used all kinds of measures, like water cannons laced with this chemical compound, rubber bullets, you know, pepper spray, tear gas. Also, journalists got caught up in the melee. There was like a lot of chaos, and it seemed kind of sloppy. You know, usually the police are much more restrained, but it seemed very hostile. And there was like arrests of journalists as well, a few in there. And so these videos emerged of police brutality, and this caused, unsurprisingly, outrage even more. So the next day, even more people showed up. And so what's happening is most people come, they just do like a little protest, and then they go home. Right before the second protest happened, the universities canceled classes to encourage the young people to go. Young people have been very central to the former mobilizations against the foreign influence law. The opposition really relies on the youth for any protest. So this was encouraged. So young people stayed behind, and there was even more violence from the protesters the second night. Police, again, the same thing, all happened all night. Then the third day, all the videos, the police brutality, and so on. Of course, the government channel is like showing the protesters' violence, while the opposition channels are showing mostly police violence, right? There's no real political demand from the protesters. It's just every night, it's just like police brutality, protester violence, you know, and on and on.
Listening to you and just watching the global political scene, the role of Russia is just amazing. It's just active in every bad thing that goes on in the world. It serves an all-purpose function to allow societies not to look at their own problems and blame everything as of Russian origin. Everything bad happens comes out of Russia. The magnificent role that Russia has been promoted to in the imaginations of the West is just a remarkable thing.
Absolutely. I think that's a really accurate way of portraying it. If they're this powerful, then how are you going to defeat them, right? Like if every problem in the world and every defeat that the West has, if it's Russia, then if it's this, you know, godly force, how are they ever going to defeat it? The thing is, Russia has not played a role in direct role in this. They play a role in the sense that they exist, they're our neighbor, and there's two territories that they backed against us. And they started a war with Ukraine. Those are very strong factors to take into consideration. Any policy, any foreign policy or domestic, would consider those factors. However, where there is direct intervention is by Western governments. But no one believes the Western intervention is an intervention. That is considered a good, and it's normal. The only thing that's not normal and bad, if Lavrov or Putin makes any positive comment about Georgian government, they're like, see, intervention, you know, like, they'll be like, oh, they handled this well or something. And that becomes a political topic everyone's discussing. See, the Georgian government is backed by, you know, Russia, or Russia likes what Georgian Dream is doing. That's looked upon as an intervention. And the so-called Russian propagandists that are everywhere and in everything, that no one seems to be able to find ever, but they all are part of this imagination. The Georgian Dream is a, I believe, a pro-European government. But I think they are pragmatic, and they realize that the EU path is not bringing in the sort of economic growth. They're forcing Georgia to be a lot more war hawks than they want to be, and that their existence and the EU integration process gives leverage to non-governmental or some governmental, you know, opposition in civil society that is able to leverage EU and US against them. Georgian Dream is like, they want to do business with China. That's a strategic partner. It's not even really about Russia. I would say it's more China. They want to be able to do business with Central Asia. They want to be able to leverage everything they can, just being tied to EU in this very categorical and this sort of almost believe only one God kind of thing, right? Will limit them. And so in some way, they've called out the bluff of EU, which kind of dangles this candidacy and integration in front of them, that's not yielding the results and putting them in danger. So I look at it as a pro-EU, but the opposition does not believe that's a pro-EU stance, nor does the current constellation of EU countries, besides Hungary and Slovakia, it seems also Bulgaria and Italy came to Georgia's defense. The version of EU that it currently portrays itself is not aligned with Georgia's version of EU.
That was Sopo Japaridze, a Georgian-American organizer and journalist. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Rubber Bullets by 10cc. Till next week, bye.